Yeah, like a few of us in the program, so let me thank the organizers for this opportunity to come to this beautiful place. And well, they are now. Well, all you guys are here. So like many of us, I steadfastly ignored a series of emails asking for, to elaborate on the title. But, unlike the rest of them, this actually is a title. I didn't put this thing in. So we all know that. So Cenk especially asked me to talk about topology and experiments. Now, he also asked Liang to do that, and we saw how well that worked out. But I have a lot of respect for Cenk, and I do whatever he asks. So I decided to do that, also because you're such a sophisticated audience, I decided I could talk about somewhat half-baked things. This is the problem with talking about experiment is it's hard to make a really good story, really perfect story. Experiment is beautiful, but it takes a while to appreciate the beauty. And you sometimes have to spend a lot of time digging around in the nitty-gritty stuff. And I feel like I'm about halfway there with both these topics. So be it. Okay, sometimes, at least I used to think that it was more interesting always to hear about unfinished work than something that's finished. So, because maybe sitting in the audience, you'll be able to finish it. But anyway, I'd be very happy for your input on any of these things. So I'm going to try to cover two of these unfinished topics, which are really things that I'm working on with these two guys. Junping Liu here is a postdoc at the KITP, and he'll be talking. I'll explain his work on understand topological effects in band structures, how it has an interplay with topological defects in some magnetic system. And then I want to talk about, so both these topics are somehow associated with emergent magnetic fields, in this case in momentum space, and this kind of artificial magnetic fields in the sense of emergent gauge theories that we heard about in a number of previous talks, like Max's today, and maybe hints of how that might be related to some experiments in certain pyrochloric materials. Zhen here is actually one of Cenk's students, so graduating, looking for a postdoc, so smart guy, maybe you should hire him. So all this starts with the anomalous Hall effect, as Duncan pointed out in his talk. There's a rather old work of Karplus and Luttinger. I never realized Luttinger was such a dashing guy, who already in the 50s realized that the anomalous Hall effect was actually due to an anomalous term in the velocity, which is very much analogous to a magnetic field in momentum space, what we now call the Berry curvature. After time, eventually it was realized just that this is actually topological and can be made even more topological under some circumstances. And this has obviously led to a lot of great physics being rewarded this year, particularly. The anomalous Hall effect is also related to something we heard about a lot over the past 2 days in a couple of talks, which are vial semimetals. All the semimetals that have been studied experimentally up to now at least exist without applying fields to the sample are ones which are due to inversion symmetry breaking. But in principle, vial semimetals can arise due to time reversal symmetry breaking rather than inversion symmetry breaking. In that case, it's possible to have another interesting property of a vial semimetal, which is an anomalous Hall effect. Which is kind of semi-geometrical insofar as the magnitude of the Hall effect should be related to the separation between a pairs of vial nodes. It's a kind of dipole moment in momentum space. So somewhat similar to some of the expressions we heard in Dima Pessin's talk yesterday. Obviously, it breaks time reversal symmetry, so we would need a magnetic material, which is a vial semimetal. Anomalous Hall effect is more general. We don't need a vial semimetal to get anomalous Hall effect. It should be generically present in systems with which break time reversal symmetry and which conduct and which have a low enough symmetry as to allow a Hall conductivity. And so there are many examples. It's a long subject. You can read this gigantic review in which Ponong is one of the authors on anomalous Hall effect in ferromagnets. It's been heavily studied there. Here I want to talk rather quickly about anomalous Hall effect in an antiferromagnet. So antiferromagnet could be nice if you're interested in practical purposes, because if you can get a large anomalous Hall effect in an antiferromagnet, it might be actually useful for a device where you don't want a lot of stray magnetic fields. Relatively recently I learned about this family of materials, which is being increasingly studied today. Manganese 310 is the example I'll focus on, but there are many materials like this, actually. These are hexagonal crystals, and the manganese forms a kind of two layers of Kagame lattice like this, so the red dots here are manganese. It's an ordered antiferromagnet. It's extremely ordered. It actually orders above room temperature. And manganese has a large moment, has 3 Bohr magneton moment per manganese. It forms this kind of 120-degree-like order, which is, theoretically is easy to understand as arising due to nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange. Then there are various other anisotropies, which are smaller. There's a DM interaction, which puts the spins in the layer. And then there's some weaker anisotropy, which pins a direction. And you can see the direction here. This is a sketch of what it should look like. You can see one out of the 6 spins in a layer points inward toward the center of this hexagon. That's actually the location of a tin atom. Because of this anisotropy, so the spins actually would like to point in this direction. They can't a tiny bit, so this one keeps this direction, but this one turns a little bit inward, and this one turns a little bit inward. So there's actually a tiny ferromagnetic moment, but it's almost a perfect antiferromagnet. So the ferromagnetic moment is 2/1000ths of a Bohr magneton per manganese, while the ordered moment is 3 Bohr magneton. Okay, so this is really an antiferromagnet. It's got 2 of these layers, and they're related by inversion. So what's interesting about it is it has a pretty large Hall effect. So here are some traces of the Hall conductivity versus magnetic field. There's a little bit of hysteretic behavior as it switches at low field, but switches at quite a low field. These are different field orientations. You can see these two are 2 directions of the magnetic field in the hexagonal plane. And this is actually magnetic field normal to the plane. So it's quite switchable because of this. It switches because the magnetic field couples to this really tiny moment, to the 2/1000ths of a Bohr magneton, but it's such weak anisotropy that you can still switch it. So one thing I want to emphasize, I show you this picture of a Kagame lattice, you'd think it's 2D, but actually the Hall conductivity is in a plane which is normal to this 2D Kagame layer, okay? If you can think of the Hall conductivity as, you can define an effective magnetic field, which is just defined so that the Hall conductivity behaves as though there were a magnetic field pointing in that direction, and the effective field is in the plane of the Kagame layer. So there have been some ab initio studies of this. This is probably not the earliest one, but this is a recent one on the archive. This material has low enough symmetry that once it develops this, this kind of coplanar magnetic order, it develops vial points. So these are kind of projections of the vial points into this Kagame layer, the hexagonal Brillouin zone, and consequently, there are, at least theoretically, there are Fermi arcs of various types. Okay. So it's a nice system already for that purposes. These are at a surface. There'd be some Fermi arcs. Obviously, it's a surface. Here, they're looking at a surface on the top of the, with a hexagonal surface. What makes it interesting, though, is because of such weak anisotropy, and yet the anisotropy actually does select some discrete ordered structure. There's a rather interesting structure to the order parameter, which is not typically there in ferromagnets. It has a kind of Z6 structure. So there are six ordered domains. You can think of the ordered domains as defined, if you like, by you choose the spin, which is actually pointed to the center of the hexagon, and that spin could be this one pointing here, or this one pointing here, or this one pointing here. There's six different such domains. So mathematically, we like these types of order parameters because you can arrange the direction of that inward pointing spin point them to the corners of a hexagon. You can associate each one of these directions with a phase, which is a multiple of 2 pi over 6, and define a kind of complex order parameter. That would be the natural order parameter description of this kind of system. Consists of three pairs of time reverse domains. You know, an arrow and its opposite is its time reversal. So if you just want to think about the energetics of domains and domain walls and defects, a good description would actually be a Sine-Gordon model. So just you have some stiffness, which is set by the energy of exchange, and then some rather weak anisotropy, which selects the different domains. So this kind of model already tells you a number of things. It tells you that there'll be minimum energy domain walls, which consist of rotating this complex number by 60 degrees. They're not between time reverse states. Okay, those will be a higher energy domain wall. There are preferred directions. So if you don't align the magnetic field with this preferred direction, actually the Hall vector that defines the Hall conductivity and the magnetic field will in general not be aligned. That leads to some interesting effects. And in principle, these allow Z6 vortices. It's kind of a discrete analog of a vortex. So here's an example of a surprising effect which you could measure in such a system. So you make a Hall bar like this, I define the axes so that the A axis is kind of a nice, easy axis. It's one of the ordered axes for this pattern. And we apply, we set up the B axis to be along the long direction of the Hall bar, apply a magnetic field along that B axis, and then set the C axis to be the Y axis of the Hall bar. So if we had an ordinary, try to look for ordinary Hall effect, there wouldn't be any in this situation, of course, because we're applying B field in the plane. But because the field, the domains actually don't order, this is not an easy direction for the domain. They'll order, there are two possible domains which are equal in energy for this field orientation. So one will have the magnetization up a little bit out of the plane, and one will have it down a little bit out of the plane. And those actually have opposite Hall conductivity. So you'd have an opposite sine voltage drop here and here. Someone's actually done the experiment, but I don't have data to show you. You can ask about these domain walls. They should be very easy to produce. And do they have interesting electronic properties? So you could try to do an ab initio calculation, but a nicer thing would be to write down a simple kind of model. And we think, at least with John Peng's determined help, we think we have a reasonably simple model. I won't write it down for you, but it's basically the simplest model you can imagine consists of just one orbital on each of these tin atoms. You have hopping within the plane and then between planes. So there are two of these layers I mentioned. So this is kind of a four band model. There's spin and two states in the basis. So you can imagine electron hops from here to here, but its hopping depends on the state of the spin in between. That model produces things which are quite similar to the ab initio calculations. For example, you can calculate various amusing things. You can look at this minimal domain wall. So here's basically a magnetic state rotated by 60 degrees off across this domain wall. And not surprisingly, there are Fermi arcs and Weyl points projecting onto this domain wall. So I have a hard time finding the Fermi arcs, but I think this is one here and a bit here. You can ask Jun Peng where they are. These are the projections of these Weyl points. And they're twice as many as you would see on a surface. Just for fun, here's pictures of a Z6 vortex. This is what would happen if you actually had six of these domain walls coming together. You have all sorts of structures in the local density of states. Obviously, it's six volt symmetric. I don't know what it means. Okay. So I said it was unfinished work. I think it's interesting. The advantage of an antiferromagnet to produce produce anomalous Hall effect and vial fermions is that you have much softer textures. Those textures can be easily manipulated with magnetic fields and temperature, lots of fluctuations. The structural asymmetries that lead to inversion symmetry breaking and an inversion asymmetric vial material, you don't change them by any, except maybe extreme pressure or something. This could really be manipulated very easily in situ, and you have lots of transport probes to study. So I think there are a lot of interesting things to do. Like I said, it's unfinished work. There isn't really a punchline. We hope to study nanoscale transport. I'd like to understand if there's anything interesting about these Z6 vortices and maybe fluctuation effects on these textures. Okay, part two. So we heard a bunch about U1 spin liquids. Did you see something? So the theorist view of a U1 spin liquid is apparently this picture of dots, which is supposed to represent, I guess, the structure of different particles in the theory, which can carry electric and magnetic charge. Sorry, I only had the patience to animate three of these. Those are photons flying through. You know? The photon's missing from the picture, so. Okay. What about experiment? Well, even though we heard there are 7 types of U1 spin liquids with time reversal symmetry, and I don't know how many types of SPT phases, there are none of these in experiment. Okay. So let's see how close we can come. So this is the closest I know how to come. It's spin ice. There are many, at least 2 good systems that have experimentally been studied in this context. To a first approximation, a reasonable model is just an Ising model. You can just think of antiferromagnetically coupled Ising spins on this pyrochlore lattice, which is this funny structure of corner-shearing tetrahedra. The Ising variable really specifies whether the spin points in or out at each vertex. Because it's antiferromagnetic, what you want is a sum on every tetrahedra to equal 0 of all spins. So that means 2 in, 2 out. That's the best you can do to minimize the Ising energy. So classically, that's a classical model because all the SCs commute. There's a large degeneracy, and that's called spin ice. It has a nice feature that because the sum of the spins on every tetrahedra is 0, you can think of connecting these little arrows with lines. It doesn't really matter how you connect them inside the tetrahedron. We have a choice. You try to follow the arrows. I can follow this in arrow to that out arrow or that out arrow. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is the lines never end. So consequently, we can think of them as field lines that are divergenceless. And in the field, people will know that, who know me will know this is a almost heretical thing for me to do. I'm going to follow what people do in the field so as not to confuse you. We'll call these magnetic field lines. Okay. Because of electromagnetic duality, we can say whatever we want, electric or magnetic. But I think Senthil will be happy if I call them magnetic field lines. Okay. Always happy. Okay. Good. So these classical systems fluctuate among all these different spin configurations that could be thought of as a fluctuating soup of loops. It's a classical SAT-MEC system, but even classically it has some consequences. You can think about the statistical mechanics is sort of governed at long wavelength by just a free energy which is proportional to the field strength of this magnetic field. But because the magnetic field never stops or starts, it's divergenceless, we could write the field as the curl of a vector potential, and if you stick that in, suddenly it's a gapless theory. And indeed, if you calculate correlations of the magnetic field, they're not analytic. They have various singularities. In particular, this leads into measurable consequences in neutron scattering. This is neutron scattering data, spin flip neutron scattering data on dysprosium titanate. You see these rather nice sharp pinch points in the spectrum, which are reflection of that. Another vaunted feature of classical spin ice are magnetic monopoles. I'm sure everyone's heard about them. Those are nothing but defect tetrahedra, which cost an energy of order J, in which instead of having 2 in, 2 out, you have 3 in, 1 out, or 1 in, 3 out. You just flipped a spin. So perfectly classical defect. These are what correspond to magnetic monopoles in the U1 gauge theory picture. And because the spins carry physical dipole moments, this thing actually carries a magnetic monopole moment in terms of its magnetization. So there are numerous experiments exploring these things in spin ice. So they're really there. They behave like classical particles that diffuse around. It's like studying a polyelectrolyte. So this is, you know, here we're interested in quantum physics here. So there's a quantum version of this, at least theoretically, in which we take our spin ice Hamiltonian, we add to it various quantum terms that induce spin flips in a coherent quantum mechanical way. The simplest model, for example, would just be adding an XY exchange, but the real systems involve more. These type of interactions are definitely present in some materials, you know, which is proven by neutron scattering studies like these, where you can see, this is data, where you can see strongly dispersive magnetic excitations. The dispersion is basically roughly the strength of the of these other exchange terms. Okay, so there are several materials that were studied in this vein, ytterbium titanate. I'll talk about praseodymium zirconate. Long ago, when Mike Hermele was a graduate student here, we actually worked out how you go from classical spin ice to quantum spin ice. Basically, what Mike showed was by perturbation theory, in these quantum interactions, you induce a term which moves you through the classical ground state manifold of this classical spin ice. It takes the form, even if though microscopically the interactions are two-spin interactions, they generate these kind of six-spin interactions by perturbation theory, which kind of move these loops of magnetic flux around. In a quantum theory, the term which moves this flux around should be associated with a plaquette, and you can think about it as, in the gauge theory language, if as a cosine of the electric field piercing this plaquette. An electric field doesn't commute with the vector potential. That gives quantum uncertainty to the Hamiltonian. And so what happens in this simple model is that you have classical spin ice has this kind of spectrum. There are these magnetic monopoles at an energy of J. And at low energy, you have all these degenerate states. These degenerate states kind of split. Magnetic monopoles remain up here, but this low energy manifold of all the two in, two out states now spreads out into a range of excitations, and out of those you build not only the ground state, you build the photon of the U1 gauge theory, and you build also electric monopole excitations, and that's kind of what I'm going to focus on here. Does this really happen in experimental systems? Well, to see it experimentally, what should happen is you should see a bunch of the entropy, this is specific heat, a bunch of the entropy removed at a temperature of order J, and then at some lower temperature, the rest of the entropy should go out. And in spin ice, classical spin ice, that entropy just remains. This has been very hard to see, but there is about a year ago, a little bit less than that, I guess. When was this? Maybe only 5 months ago I saw this. So this is unpublished experimental data from Takiwa-san in Tokyo. I show it backwards, so I guess it's okay to show the unpublished data backwards. So this was at the SCES conference in Hangzhou, and Pierce Coleman actually stole the data from the guy's talk and published it in a paper on the archive, so I really don't feel too bad about it. And he didn't flip it over. But, so you can see it's not specific heat, it's thermal conductivity, because specific heat is very difficult to measure. You can't see the temperature scale that well, but this is, this is half a Kelvin, so this is maybe 100 millikelvin. At this temperature, nuclear specific heat interferes with specific heat measurement. But since the nuclei are localized, they don't contribute to thermal conductivity, so you can still measure thermal conductivity. This is praseodymium zirconate. You can kind of see a lot of the entropy is quenched out, and this thermal conductivity peak is presumably associated with removing the rest of the entropy. So maybe they're actually in this kind of coherent quantum spin ice regime. So let me return to this nice picture, which Max and others and Senthil have shown. So this U1 spin liquid should have all these interesting excitations. The classical spin liquid already has the excitations on this axis. So the center is kind of the nothing particle. This is the magnetic monopole. It has a large energy of order J. The fully quantum particles are the electric charges over here, which have an energy much less than J. So they're the lowest energy excitations of such a system. And they're really purely quantum. You can't think about them in a classical way in spin ice. So I wish I could claim that we had in our hands a U1 spin liquid and we can measure all these things. There are lots of experiments. You'll find more, some every week or two. There are many claims. I don't think there's any clear observation. There are lots of difficulties. I won't go over them given the time constraints. What I do want to do is try to, again, come back to experiments and say some speculative things about topology. So I want to talk about a couple praseodymium systems. This is a very famous material, praseodymium iridate. It's a very puzzling material with extremely rich physics. Almost any phenomena you can think of in condensed matter occurs in this material. It's complicated. It has actually two pyrochlore lattices. One of them is a lattice of the praseodymium spins, which are kind of spin ice-like, and has another pyrochlore sublattice of iridium atoms, which has conduction electrons on it. So this is a conducting material. It has a strong spin orbit. It's extremely complicated. It does a lot of intriguing things. For example, it has a logarithmic susceptibility at low temperature. This is the thing it's probably most famous for. Bless you, whatever that was. It has a spontaneous zero field Hall effect over a certain range of temperatures. You see a Hall effect in zero field without any measurable magnetization. Where does that Hall effect come from? Nobody really knows. But there have been some recent clues, and I kind of want to pursue these recent clues. Okay, so these recent clues, I interpret them to tell us a few things. So these are what I'd like to interpret them to say. One, the system is close to a zero field quantum critical point. Two, the electrons are actually not very important for that quantum critical point. All the physics is really coming from the spins. Moreover, by very small changes to these samples, you can actually induce the praseodymium spins to order. And perhaps that's telling us what the phase is on the other side of the quantum critical point. So let me quickly show you some of those experiments. It seems like a bizarre experiment if you've never seen it before. This is called the magnetic Grüneisen parameter. Some weird ratio of thermodynamic quantities, the temperature derivative of the magnetization divided by the specific heat. But by thermodynamic relations, you can write it as 1 over temperature times the field derivative of temperature at constant entropy. So it's a strange quantity. There's Natty Seiberg was talking. He has a machine to produce dualities. This guy has a machine. Philip Gegenwart has a machine to produce magnetic Grüneisen parameter. Okay. It's a real machine. It's not like a theoretical machine. So the nice thing about this quantity is, you know, dimensionally, it's just 1 over field. So it's very natural that if field is a relevant parameter in a critical system, this thing will diverge as field goes to zero, and temperature goes to zero. And so it does in many systems. When it diverges towards zero field, it's an indication of a quantum critical point, or at least a quantum critical system, at zero field. And so that indeed happens in this praseodymium iridate. I should say this is not expected for a quantum spin liquid phase, so this was a puzzling observation. So a little bit of more data. You don't really need to look at it that much other than to say that this parameter roughly obeys a scaling relation. It not surprisingly behaves like 1 over field, but you can collapse it to a scaling function of H divided by some power of temperature. So one of the, that's somewhat old. One of the very recent clues, which again is not published, but Tokiwa-san has worked on this other material, praseodymium zirconate. So if you compare the previous slide, praseodymium iridate, praseodymium zirconate, only one thing changed. Iridium turned to zirconium. Basically, the data looks very, very similar. However, an important thing happened. All the conduction electrons went away. This is an insulator. Okay, so that tells you that at least all these indications of quantum criticality, they don't have anything to do with the electrons. Okay. Another interesting observation is that you go back to praseodymium iridate, just been more studied, I think. Very small changes in the stoichiometry of this material, really tiny chemical changes at the level of a few tenths of a percent, actually induce it to order. So here's a Bragg peak developing. A Bragg peak in the 100 direction develops at a temperature around a little under a Kelvin, and these praseodymium spins order. So this is a particular ordered state. We actually know it's nearby. Okay. So based on this thing, there's a suggestion, not my suggestion, it's actually Gong Chen, who was a student of mine a number of years back, and I'm really largely just following up his work here in the rest of this talk. He made the suggestion that these observations are related and that the system may be actually near a quantum critical point between a U1 spin liquid and this ordered state. Okay.
Is your state still 2 o'clock?
It is, yeah. It's a It's a particular state within the two in, two out manifold that doubles the unit cell. So that's a good question. It's within the two in, two out. So you can think that it should be built out of the states that came out of the two in, two out states. So how should you think about this transition? Well, we had kind of two particle-like excitations in the system, the magnetic and electric particle. The electric particle has much lower energy. So if one of them is going to get driven to zero by some parameter, additional interactions, it's probably the E particle, probably the electric particle.
We could
try to think about this transition as a condensation of this electric charge. Electric charge is kind of interesting. It hops around on a lattice, which is a kind of dual diamond lattice.
It's probably my mom. Yep.
That's my mom. I'll get her later. So it hops around on a dual diamond lattice. If you look, want to know where the original spins are, they actually, basically they sit in the centers of these kind of warped hexagonal plaquettes of the diamond lattice. And so the spin in the spin-ice system was kind of mapped to a magnetic field. So our electric particles see a flux as they go around here. This is a remnant of the spin one-half nature of the spins. So as Duncan showed us in spin chains, there's a difference between spin one-half and spin one, and that's a difference here. The electric particles in this U1 spin liquid see some flux. By the way, this is an effect, outside the classification you talked about. You were Senthil in your first talk, where you made the case that time reversal is the only robust symmetry we should worry about in systems. But sometimes the lattice matters, even spatial symmetries matter. So this is an example. So if you want to think about this, you should think about these monopoles kind of hopping around in a pattern of some background flux. But of course, they're also coupled to the emergent gauge field of this U1 electrodynamics. So if you do the exercise of actually asking what is the band structure for these electric charges moving in the background of this flux, it's kind of funny. It works out that the minima of this band, actually they lie along lines and they form this kind of funny structure here. A network of three intersecting lines. So I'm not sure how robust this is,
it may be interesting.
So how would you think about this? Well, the kind of model you would write down to try and understand this transition would be in terms of a field which creates and annihilates these electric charges. They hop around on the lattice, they experience some potential, use this potential to tune the transition, and they're coupled to some gauge field. What Gong was already able to show is that actually, if you condense these electric charges with this kind of band structure, these are the kind of the minimum where the low energy Bose condensates would form, this actually leads to the observed 1-0-0 order. Okay. So the theory has the ingredients to describe this transition. There are various scenarios. I meant on this slide to sort of point out some of the uncertainties. I put a second time derivative here. That implies some particle hole symmetry. Is there actually a reason for it? Should we or should we not split the line degeneracy here? So these are, I said it's an unfinished project, so. Sorry? Yeah, so the interactions in here, they favor condensing at just a discrete set of points of these lines. And basically, which line you choose will pick which of these different 1-0-0 or 0-1-0 or 0-0-1 ordered states.
Okay.
That's.
You said that the order state is not in this
cell. Yes.
Is the momentum of this electric charge minimum at the.
Well, so the momentum of the electric charges is not a gauge invariant concept, but differences of momentum are. So I can shift this pattern around in momentum space depending how I choose a gauge. So that doesn't really have a meaning, but the fact that it has multiple minima in momentum space, that has a meaning. Okay. So let me just give the rough idea. So the simplest scenario would be that this line degeneracy is actually broken, but we have particle hole symmetry. Then the theoretical description would basically be a Ginzburg-Landau theory of some type, and we'd have a transition between these two phases. Okay, I'm going to take like three more minutes. All right. So actually, I have only one point in this latter part of the story, which is this one, which is coming back to this magnetic Grunheisen parameter. You know, this is all to do with sensitivity to magnetic fields. Why should this thing have a sensitivity to magnetic field? And how does it work? So how does a magnetic field actually couple to this thing? So microscopically, this is all just spins. And we know how the magnetic field couples. It couples entirely via Zeeman coupling to these precedimium spins. It looks something like this. It's a particularly kind of funny Zeeman coupling because the local axis of these spins is non-collinear. But if you put this in, you work it all through, like do the duality, everything you need to do to actually describe these electric particles, you find an amazing and simple result is that this external magnetic field, in the end, just couples to the emergent magnetic field. Okay, it's maybe it seems obvious, but it's not obvious, I think, because you need this specific form of the Zeeman interaction to get this answer. Okay, so what it means is that from the point of view of this kind of fluctuating superconductor, the way a magnetic field affects it is just like an orbital field. This magnetic Grunheisen parameter is entirely related to thermodynamics. It's all funny derivatives of the free energy. So really, you're trying to, if you want to understand this, you're trying to understand the Landau diamagnetism of this fluctuating superconductor. Okay, so we can do some scaling arguments and back them up by doing actually calculating Landau diamagnetism. But basically, what it will give is a form like this, which is the same kind of scaling form predicted by, you know, which is what they use to fit the data. But which scaling exponent you get depends on details like, do I preserve these line node degeneracies or do I break them? Do I assume particle hole symmetry or not? There's some particular value gives this exponent 3/2, which is what they actually observe in experiment, but I wouldn't place too much faith in it. So work in progress. Let me take 1 or 2 minutes just to summarize. So. What's really interesting about these U1 spin liquids, which is like a topological phases, is that they have emergent particles which are non-local. And they're, in a way, they're very simple. They carry integer electric and magnetic charges. And the nice thing about at least this particular way to realize a spin liquid or phases close to it is that you really can experimentally tune the magnetic field, the emergent magnetic field, by just tuning the physical magnetic field. I think it's a non-trivial result. If these emergent electric charges go to low energy, then this kind of critical response to field and the scaling of it is natural. There are lots of questions. What is the role of the line degeneracy? What's the role of particle symmetry? How should we treat the gauge interactions? Is disorder important? Maybe more interesting question is, once we accept that these electric particles are low energy excitations and we can actually tune the magnetic field they see, are there other signatures of these particles? And maybe they're actually related to the Hall effect. They carry an electric charge. They see the external field like a real field. They should experience a Hall effect. Of course, their electric charge is not the physical electric charge. It's an emergent electric charge. So how does that emergent, how does an emergent Hall conductivity get translate into a real Hall conductivity? That's maybe an interesting problem. Okay, thanks.
Questions?
This is to show that these guys have a lot more work to do.
Questions? Anybody other than Chenko?
Quick question, yeah. The line of degeneracy talk about, just to make sure, these are lowest energy.
Yes, that's
it's
the
not
minimum.
Not like the line minimum, not like the crossing in top of the
It's not a crossing, it's the minimum of the lowest band.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what's relevant for bosons.
Leon, I was confused by the Landau diamagnetism. Are there, were you referring to the metallic pyrochlore here, the iridate?
There are a couple of misuses of language there. Maybe I should say fluctuation diamagnetism, but I'm actually talking about emergent diamagnetism, not physical diamagnetism. So,
this would be emergent.
Yeah.
How do you measure that?
So the claim is that a physical magnetic field couples directly to this emergent magnetic field. So actually, the free energy with respect, derivatives with respect to the physical magnetic field probe that diamagnetism. Okay. There's a kind of RPA inversion you have to do, but basically, yes. She's very selective.
I feel bad now. So, the two materials that you mentioned, is the idea that somehow they're both accidentally closed quantum critical?
Yeah. Okay, good question. There's an assumption here, you know, that praseodymium iridate and praseodymium zirconate are pretty similar as far as the praseodymium is concerned. Indeed. So this material is clearly close to a phase transition because this is the one which has been studied by small changes to the stoichiometry and can produce the ordered phase. The praseodymium zirconate, I don't know that that's true. But at least this one is. And there's a lot more data on this one. But this one is the one which is in principle more complicated because it has it has Fermi surface and low energy electrons. However, you know, all these thermodynamic quantities look extremely similar in the two materials, so most likely that's not playing a role.
I see. And the quick second question, I guess, if the line degeneracy is lifted, aren't these transitions in 3+1D usually fluctuation-induced first order?
So, first, I don't expect it to be lifted entirely, but it would be lifted to some degenerate set of points. And then very likely that's true. Now, you know, the experiments don't measure down to the lowest temperatures. You know, if we look at this thing, there's actually some little line in here where something more complicated happens. And if you look at the scaling, it's not perfect. There are these roll-offs. These are basically very low temperature. This scaling kind of cuts off. So there's room. Experiment is never down to zero temperature, never really to infinite correlation length.
I guess you have to be kind of lucky.
You do.
The couplings have to be weak so that it's actually...
I'm willing to be impure. Yeah. If we do preserve the line degeneracies, it's less obvious, but
Leon, could you connect the story over here to the other iridates, the 227, that you've studied yourself? So there is a magnetic order, which is believed to be on the iridium side. And then maybe at lower temperatures, praseodymiums, but it's also orders. So the praseodymium is kind of outliers, you know, in that series. It's metallic. So where is zirconium, praseodymium zirconate in that sequence? And when you show...
It's not in that sequence.
Right. But where does it in the hypothetical, you know, in a presumptive theoretical phase diagram? Is it the same kind of order when you refer to this one?
Okay, so what I would say, probably what's the case is that for all the praseodymium compounds, the native interactions between the praseodymium would prefer the 2-in-2 out order. But if the iridium orders in some other way, it's a much higher energy phenomena, and it enslaves the praseodymium to follow it.
So when you showed McLaughlin's MuSAR data, I believe, right, was that... Is that interpreted as praseodymium ordering?
It is.
That
it's praseodymium ordering. Oh, yeah. It's praseodymium ordering.
So it is different in that sense from the other iridium compounds that I've alluded to.
Yeah, it's very different. It's completely different order. It enlarges the unit cell, which those don't.
Okay, so it's not 3-in-1-out.
No, it's totally different.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I guess one of the predictions you might make for the fact that these electric charges see the field as an orbital field is you would get thermal Hall effect.
Indeed,
the large
yeah.
thermal Hall effect.
Yeah, yeah.
That may be the easiest thing to look for.
Yeah, in the zirconate, for example. Yeah, agreed. Yeah. One can always ask for new experiments, new hard experiments, but on the other hand, there are existing experiments. The electrical Hall effect has been measured already in praseodymium iridate and doesn't have an explanation. So maybe one should work to see if that can be understood first in this framework. Very likely, yes. Yeah.
to the next talk because that's what's between us and the dinner.
So. Yeah, I don't want to be that.
The next speaker is, oh yes, let's thank him again.